Romans chapter 4, beginning in verse 9. Cometh this blessedness then upon the circumcision only, or upon the uncircumcision also? And again, those are synonymous terms for the Jews and the Gentiles, circumcision, Jew, uncircumcision, name for the Gentiles. For we say that faith was reckoned to Abraham for righteousness. How was it then reckoned? When he was in circumcision or in uncircumcision? Not in circumcision, but in uncircumcision. Removing every possible doubt, every possibility that Abraham's righteousness or the righteousness of God could have been reckoned to Abraham because of any meritorious deed, anything he did on his part. It was through faith alone, and Paul is trying to make that crystal clear. Verse 11, and he received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith, which he had yet being uncircumcised, that he might be the father of all them that believe, though they be not circumcised, that righteousness might be imputed unto them also. And the father of circumcision to them who are not of the circumcision only, but who also walk in the steps of that faith of our father Abraham, which he had being yet uncircumcised. So in verse 11 and 12, Paul is pointing out that Abraham can rightly be called the father. He's father of two classes. He's the father of all who are justified by faith. In verse 11, circumcision notwithstanding. He's speaking especially of the Gentiles, though they be not circumcised. Especially the Gentiles, but Jew or Gentile, circumcision or uncircumcision, Abraham can rightly be considered their father if they are justified by faith. He's the father of all those who are justified by faith and faith alone. In that sense, verse 11 and verse 12, Paul tells us that Abraham can rightly be considered the father also of those who are Jews, the circumcision, but who are Jews and of the circumcision in the true sense, who know the reality of the true meaning of circumcision, which is to walk by faith in the living God in a path of separation from the pollution of this world, separation unto the living God. So as the father of two categories, all those who are justified by faith, and all those who may be circumcised, yes, they're of the Jews, but they know the true meaning of circumcision, which is a spiritual separation unto God, and they walk accordingly, as Abraham did. They walk in the path of righteousness by faith in the living God, as Abraham did. There, Abraham can rightly be considered the father of all them as well. Those who are saved by faith and those who walk the walk of separation by faith. Walk by faith. In verse 13, for the promise that he should be the heir of the world was not to Abraham or to his seed through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. For if they which are of the law be heirs, faith is made void, and the promise made of none effect. Now, there's no specific promise that we know of in the Abrahamic covenant or any of the articulations of the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis 12 or Genesis 15 or Genesis 17. But we believe that this is a kind of a figurative way of summing up the gist of the Abrahamic covenant, that Abraham and through his seed would be blessed and would be a source of blessing to all the world, that in effect, through his seed, he would take the place of Adam in dominion over the world, claiming God's place in this world, spiritually speaking. So through his spiritual fatherhood, you can say in a figurative way, Abraham becomes the heir of the earth, inherits the earth, or the heir of the world. So we believe that's a figurative way of summing up all of the Abrahamic covenants, the heir of the world. Now, Paul says that this promise that Abraham should be the heir of the world was on the basis entirely of God's performance and not man's. It was in the realm of promise. It's God's promise, not hinging on any performance of man. It's not conditioned on that. It's what we call an unconditional covenant. All on God's performance, not at all on man's. It's on the basis of righteousness freely provided to those who believe, on the basis of dorean, absolutely free, without cost, for nothing, on the basis of charis, sorry to give you the Greek spelling, charis, or grace, unmerited favor. Go Going back to those two words which we found in Romans 3:24, being justified freely by His grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. So now he says in verse 13, for the promise that he should be the heir of the world was not to Abraham or to his seed through the law, on the basis of human performance, in other words, but through the righteousness of faith. It was on the basis of this righteousness freely provided on the basis of faith alone. Dora'an, on this basis, absolutely free. Charis, on this basis, unmerited favor. It was on the same basis. It was God's to give and Abraham's merely to receive. The promise that he should be the heir of the world was not to Abraham or to his seed through the law, human performance, but on the same basis as the righteousness of faith. Verse 14, for if they which are of the law be heirs, faith is made void, and the promise made of none effect. If they which are of the law be heirs, in other words, if it's on the basis of law that this inheritance is received, on the basis of human performance, then faith is made void and the promise made of none effect. So you see, he's talking about the tendency to mix faith and grace with human works of some kind, with human performance of some kind. And Paul says if you add works in, if you add the requirement for works in on the basis of law, then what you've done is nullify faith, and the promise basis is out of the picture. If by law, he's saying faith then in God and his performance, the promise basis, is shut out. Because then you're putting it back on the law basis, which is reliance on human performance. He uses two Greek words here. First one, kekenotai, which is made void or empty. Kenotai. If they which are of the law be heirs, those who are relying on human performance, then faith is kikenotai. It's made void. It's made empty. And the promise is made of none effect. And another Greek word is used there, one we've already seen, katargeo. These two Greek words are used, they're synonymous. They're synonyms. And katargeo means nullified, rendered void, done away, destroyed. Made of no effect. We're going to see this katargeo again in a very significant place as we go on in the book of Romans. And I bring it up now because he uses these two words right here together, again, for emphasis. They're synonyms. He's saying the same thing twice, basically. If they which are of the law be heirs, if we're back on the basis of human performance and all those who trust in the law, if they're the ones who become heirs, then what you do is shut faith of God out. And what you do is make the promise basis of none effect, nullified, rendered void, done away, destroyed. You cannot mix the two. There's no mixing of the two. They're absolutely mutually exclusive. The minute we make human performance in the smallest measure a necessary part of the equation, then that makes the whole enchilada ultimately, in the final analysis, dependent on me, because I must do my part. If you say it's 90% God, 10% man, well, in the final analysis, that 10% must be done. And so in the final analysis, it depends on me doing my part. If you say 99% of God, 1% man, it still makes that 1% a necessary part of the equation. In the final analysis, it ultimately depends on me, because if I don't do my 1%, the whole thing falls. If you make it 99.9% dependent on God and 0.1% dependent on me, in the final analysis, it's still dependent on me doing my 1/10 of 1%. And so it becomes dependent on man, and you shut out faith, and you shut out promise. And I use these figures, they're not out of the question, they're not ridiculous, and I didn't pull them out of my head. You ask Roman Catholic theologians, I have quotations, cardinals, bishops, and they will say, yes, we're saved by grace through faith. And they'll say, finally, you know, when you back them into a corner, you say, give me the figures, how much depends on me? Some have actually said 10% man, 90% God. Some have actually said 1% man, 99% God. Can't get them to agree, but all of them put some little minute proportion of the thing dependent on man. Man becomes a necessary part of the equation. The faith basis then falls. The grace basis then falls. The promise basis then falls. It's ultimately, in the final analysis, still a human performance. And Paul says that cannot be. If they which are of the law be heirs, faith is made void, the promise made of none effect. Verse 15, because, here's the reason, the law worketh wrath. For where no law is, there is no transgression. I would like you to repeat after me now the law of law. The law of law is, no, don't, not that part. I'm going to tell you what it is. Ain't it? The law of law is law worketh wrath. Say that with me. Law worketh wrath. Thank you. The inevitable result of law in every single case, every single time, is wrath. The inevitable, always, ultimate outcome of law will always, always, always be wrath. Law worketh wrath. This is continuous tense. Law worketh wrath every single time in every single case. Guaranteed outcome. Guaranteed outcome. Look with me at Galatians chapter 3, verse 10. Here's why. Galatians 3, verse 10. Galatians 3, verse 10. For as many as are of the works of the law, that means every single one who's of the works of the law, as many as are of the works of the law are under the curse. As soon as you take law upon yourself, you're under a curse. It's automatic. It's guaranteed. As many as are of the works of the law are under the curse. For it is written, cursed is everyone that continueth not in all things which are written in the book of the law to do them. Lots said in this verse. Everyone that continueth not, and continueth not here is continuous tense. That means continue and continue and continue always in all things which are written in the book of the law to do them. Okay, what this means, this verse means, Galatians 3:10 means that if you come under the law, that means you must perform the things of the law. You must perform them at the standard or level of perfection, and you must do them all the time without fail ever, and you must do all of them. All of them, all the time, to the level of perfection, must be performed. That's why everyone who takes the law on himself is under a curse, because nobody can do that. Because we have a sin nature which will eventually show itself. We will eventually, sooner or later, fail. And we'll fail big time. It's going to come. It's like my friend Dean, who led me to the Lord years ago. He was a biker. He was a Triumph man. Rode his Triumph motorcycle around and wore his leather jacket proudly. And he worked for a while in a motorcycle store, you know, selling motorcycle paraphernalia, basically. And they had a deal with this leather warehouse downtown Detroit where they would sell some of their leather jackets and some of the leather paraphernalia in their store. And he would talk to other bikers. And he worked with me at the radio station for a while. We did an interview show where we would interview various Christians. And we interviewed this group called the King's Kids, which was a bunch of born-again motorcycle guys, ex-Detroit motorcycle gang outlaws who now became saved and became part of this Christian motorcycle gang called the King's Kids. And he was talking to these guys as they came in for the interview. And I'll tell you what, they looked like pretty tough hombres, you know. They came in. They looked like they could have been Hell's Angels, but now they were King's Kids. And I was talking to them and talking about bikes, and I was sitting there listening. I know nothing about it. I hadn't even been on a motorcycle ever since at that point. And he said with his wry kind of smile, they were talking about all their scrapes and skirmishes from having road burn, you know, having gone down on their bikes. And Dean said with his wry smile, he says, yeah, there's only two kinds of bikers I know, those that have been down and those that are going down soon. You know? Like everybody who ever gets on a motorcycle crashes eventually. And I don't think it's quite that absolute, but that was his and a cynical outlook on life at that point. Those that have been down, those that are going down soon. The inevitable result of riding motorcycles, according to Dean. The inevitable result of law, according to Paul, according to God, is wrath every single time. Curse, wrath, condemnation, every single time. Brings me under condemnation because it demands continuous perfect obedience. We have a sin nature which will ultimately fail, cause us to fail and be exposed. Verse 16, Romans 4. Romans 4, verse 16. Therefore, it is of faith that it might be by grace, to the end that the promise, to the end the promise might be sure to all the seed, not to that which is of the law, but to that also which is of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. As it is written, I have made thee a father of many nations before him whom he believed, even God, who quickeneth the dead, and calleth those things which be not as though they were. The inevitable result of law is wrath. On the other hand, the inevitable result of grace is blessed assurance. Is the word sure here, that the promise might be sure to all the seed, simply means certain of fulfillment. You add law in, human performance in any measure, and it brings the whole thing down to human performance, necessary part of the equation. So what do you got there? You've got, the only certainty you've got is of ultimate failure. Sooner or later, you're going to come under a curse. Sooner or later, you're going to fail. But you want the promise certain of fulfillment, then it must be on the grace-faith basis. Faith and grace is the formula to blessed assurance. Therefore, it is a faith that it might be by grace, to the end the promise might be sure to all the seed, certain of fulfillment, not to that only which is of the law, but to that also which is of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. Grace means God doing. Grace means God's performance. It means all depends on Him. And that's the only time we have certainty. The only certainty we have of fulfillment is when it's 100% dependent on God, 0% dependent on me. That's the only time we have certainty. 100% dependent on God, 0% dependent on me. Faith means me relying. Nothing depends on me. Faith means I am merely latching on to His provision, His performance. He's doing it all. Therefore, it is of faith that it might be by grace, to the end the promise might be sure to all the seed. If it's by faith, that means it's me relying entirely on God, then we're on the grace basis. Therefore, it is of faith that it might be by grace, to the end that the promise might be sure, certain of fulfillment, to all the seed. If it's by faith, that means I'm relying entirely on God, nothing on me. It's entirely then on the grace basis, and that's my guarantee and my only guarantee of fulfillment, the only time I can be sure. Promise of God is 100% certain of fulfillment only because it depends 100% on God and God's performance. God cannot lie, He cannot err, He cannot fail, but I can and I will. And this, folks, is the fallacy of promise keepers. Because according to the Bible, there is only one promise keeper. And if you were really, truly going to have a promise keepers convention, only one would show. And His name would be Jesus Christ. Because He's the only true promise keeper. By nature, we are promise breakers. Look with me at Romans chapter 1. And God knows this. This is no secret to God, but we keep forgetting, or we never come to that place where we fully understand or admit it. Romans 1:31, this is that list of heinous sins, all the categories of sins that you studied Like in Romans 1:29, being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, despiteful, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection, implacable, unmerciful, who knowing the judgment of God that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. We are characterized by covenant breaking or promise breaking. That's what characterizes man. That's why in Romans chapter 3, what advantage then hath the Jew, or what profit is there of circumcision? Verse 2, much every way, chiefly because that unto them were committed the oracles of God. What if some did not believe? Shall their unbelief make the faithfulness or faith of God without effect? God forbid, yea, let God be true, but every man a liar. Every man a liar. God is the promise keeper. We are promise breakers. Matter of fact, first Promise Keepers Convention, they say, was at the foot of Mount Sinai years ago. Whatever God says, we'll do it. First Promise Keepers Convention in history. That's why God tells us not to make a lot of covenants and oaths and promises. In James, he says, don't say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. If the Lord wills, he says, you don't know what tomorrow brings. He tells us not to go around making a lot of covenants, a lot of promises, taking a lot of oaths. Waldenses, in fact, that was part of their creed, part of their doctrine, part of their practices. They didn't make covenants. They didn't make oaths. They didn't make promises, especially having to do with their sanctification. There was the record, the account, you know, when they started hauling these Waldenses in, they started going up into the villages during the beginning of the Inquisition, 12th, 13th century. They went into this one Waldensian village and they took them all in, under house arrest, and they transported them back over into their Roman Catholic city out of the Alps, and they put them on trial. And there's one little old lady, I mean an elderly woman, near 80, and they brought her in and put her under arrest, and they interrogated her, and they wanted to put her under oath, you know, to give witness. Like in our courts of law, I will tell the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help me God, hand on the Bible. She refused to do so. She said, don't ask me to make some oath. Don't ask me to make some promise. God's the only one who makes oaths and promises. She wouldn't do it. And they said, don't you understand that we have the power to put you to death? We'll burn you at the stake unless you can give testimony as to what you truly believe and what you've truly done. She said, well, you do what you have to do. I'm not going under oath here. They burned her at the stake. Brave, bold woman, courageous in the faith. But she refused to make promises because she recognized God is the promise maker. And he's the promise keeper. Of course, now, you know, we don't want to get so extreme about this. We're not rational anymore. I put Abel up in his bed at night, you know, and sometimes I have a hard time resisting tickling the guy. The little guy has such an infectious laugh. I enjoy it. I'm going to miss that when he's 16. I don't think his laugh is going to be quite as infectious. He's got this little giggle, and he delights, actually, in me tickling him. But sometimes it's a little too much. It gets a little too intense. And so I used to put him up in his bed and he'd scamper way to the other corner, you know, out of reach. I'd say, Abel, come over here. And no, Dad, you're going to tickle me. I say, I'm not going to tickle you. And he'd say, promise? And sometimes I'd say, yes, I promise, you know. And I brought that up in class last year. And then he would come over, you know. Then the tension would go and he'd come over. He'd believe me when I would promise I wasn't going to tickle him. I brought that up in class a year ago, and somebody who, you know, as an ardent defender of promise keepers, I didn't know it at the time, he was offended by my promise keeper's remarks. He said, Mr. Richards, excuse me, but aren't we not to make promises? Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah, I didn't realize that. I guess it hasn't soaked into that extent to the fiber of my very being. So I told Abel about that. I said, Abel, we can't be making promises. Let your yea be yea and your nay be nay. And so he said, okay. So the next night I put him up in his bed, and he goes way over to this opposite corner, and I said, Abel, come here. He said, you're going to tickle me, Dad. I said, no, I won't. He said, Dad, you promised. I said, no, we talked about that, Abel. I'm not going to promise. Let your yea be yea and your nay, nay. And he said, well, that means you're promising, right? couldn't quite go with it yet, you know. After a while, he was able to accept that as that's Daddy's word, and so I'm going to go with it. Yes, Dargail? Thank you. I think there's a place for saying, by God's grace, you know, I resolve. But we have to be careful about these resolutions and these promises, especially when we put that up in the forefront. Men of integrity making these promises, and we're basing our sanctification on that. That seems to speak directly against what God is talking about here, putting faith in men, putting faith in my ability to carry out certain promises and covenants and agreements. I think it's that kind of reliance that can very easily become a reliance on flesh. And since at the Promise Keepers Conventions, we're really talking about a wide mix of saved and unsaved, and we're asking them to commit to seven promises and become men of integrity, I really think the emphasis is unbiblical. Now, I believe, you know, there's a marriage covenant, which is obviously honored by God. There's business contracts that Christians are not forbidden from entering into. And there's agreements that I enter into when I become accountable to another brother and things like that. But we have to be very careful. We have to be careful not to violate the spirit of what is written here. And again, we have to be careful not to be going to such extremes that I can't promise Abel I'm not going to tickle him. You know, promise him, Lord willing, if it doesn't rain, I'm going to take you to a baseball game tomorrow. But I think we have to be very careful about that. Reuben? I'm sorry. I don't think you should go around making a lot of covenants. I think you should say, you know, this is my intent, and by God's grace, Lord willing, this is what I will do. Okay? There's another thing, too, where we don't enter into any kind of resolve either, where we have this weak-willed kind of nothingness. I don't know, I'll tell you a story about that sometime, but I think we do have to put our faith in God and claim that verse, I can do all things through Christ who strengtheneth me. But not to make a lot of commitments, and certainly not to shift the emphasis onto reliance on my own strength. Reuben? And you make some kind of public declaration too, then I think it becomes a human pride thing and human reliance. Well, how do you interpret it? Look with me at James chapter 5. James chapter 5, verse 12. But above all things, my brethren, swear not, neither by heaven, neither by the earth, neither by any other oath, but let your yea be yea, and your nay, nay, lest you fall into condemnation. Look back with me at James chapter 4. James chapter 4, verse 13. Go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow, we will go into such a city and continue there a year, and buy and sell and get gain, whereas ye know not what shall be on the morrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. For that ye ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. But now ye rejoice in your boastings. All such rejoicing is evil. Therefore to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. How about Matthew, Sermon on the Mount, chapter 6. Matthew chapter 5, verse 33. Again, ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay, for whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil. So I'll leave that between you and the Lord. You know, I'm not going to make that application for you. I think there are certain things where it's an individual's accountability to his God and how we apply these. Obviously, as I mentioned, there are certain situations where covenants, agreements are sanctioned of God. The marriage is one, marriage covenant. Business agreements, I think, are a part of life, and we rely on those. Maybe the military is one too, but that's something I would exhort you to search out in your own heart between you and God. I'm not going to tell you, you know, what I would do. John, real quick, because we have to go on. Well, I guess you could say that about just about everything. We have to be careful that we don't excuse ourselves from obedience through cultural considerations. I think there are universal principles that apply, timeless principles that apply. And certainly there are aspects of that culture that might enter into our understanding of it. In terms of our application, we have to be careful we don't excuse ourselves from obedience through saying, well, that's just the culture of their day. As for me, I'm not going to call myself a promise keeper. You know, it comes right down to it. I'm not going to go to a promise keeper's rally, and I'm not going to call myself a promise keeper. What you guys do is between you and the Lord. Okay? Turn with me to Romans. Romans chapter 4. Verse 17. As it is written, I have made thee a father of many nations before him whom he believed, even God who quickeneth the dead and calleth those things which be not as though they were, who against hope believed in hope that he might become the father of many nations, according to that which was spoken, so shall thy seed be. Excuse me. Now this is what I like about God as a promise keeper. He says, as it is written, verse 17, I have made thee a father of many nations. What strikes you about that promise? Past tense. When you can make promises in the past tense, then you can call yourself a promise keeper. God makes promises in the past tense. And that's striking. Look back with me at Genesis 17, the original context. Genesis chapter 17. Hold your place in Romans 4. I'm not one who's really timid about my words. I tend to give my opinions and my conclusions, and sometimes pretty dogmatically, but there is nothing I have ever spoken out about in all my history of preaching and teaching here at New Tribes or elsewhere that arouses such ire and wrath as say a word against promise keepers. I tell you what, you swat a hornet's nest when you do that. Sometimes you don't even know it. I've had guys tell me they had animosity towards me from day one because somebody told them I was anti-promise keepers when they came in here as a freshman and moved into the dorm. And I didn't even know it for 2 years till they're ready to graduate and they come see me in my office. Interesting. Genesis chapter 17, verse 5. Neither shall thy name any more be called Abram, but thy name shall be Abraham, for a father of many nations have I made thee. Past tense. Now, you know, we can kind of understand verse 4. As for me, behold, my covenant is with thee, and thou shalt be a father of many nations. We can kind of understand verse 16. And I will bless her, he says to Sarah, and give thee a son also of her. Yea, I will bless her, future, and she shall be a mother of many nations. A mother of nations, king of people shall be of her. Kings of people shall be of her. We can kind of relate to verse 4 and verse 16. Those are future, but verse 5 ought to strike us. Because God just made a promise here in the past tense. I have made thee a father of many nations. Abraham's 100. Or not quite at this point. But he's going to be 100 years old. His wife is barren. She's old. She's been barren a long time. And Abraham says, I have made you a father of many nations. And I'm sorry, God says that. Abraham believes in a God that makes promises in the past tense. This is like, you know, I could say to Danica this morning, I could say, Danica, your mother and I have been praying for your future spouse, that if it's the Lord's will, that someday you would marry the right man, he would come along and you would fall in love with him and court him properly, and he would be the kind of man that will be the spiritual leader of your household and hopefully point you to full-time Christian service or aspect of Christian service that will be glorifying to God, and he will honor you and be an encourager to you and nurture you in his love and in the words of God. We've prayed for that, Danica, and we've laid a little money aside for your wedding eventually, and we've even got a church that we think would be very appropriate for you to get married in. I could say that to Danica, or I could say, Danica, as she wakes up in the morning, your mom and I married you off to Josh Jeanette last night. As of last night, you are now Mrs. Josh Jeanette. It was a wonderful wedding. Billie Jean James did the floral arrangement. Don Gerst did the service. It was tremendous. We even saved a piece of cake for you, Danica, or I should say Mrs. Jeanette. You know, that's calling the future the past. And that's two totally different things, isn't it? God says, I have made thee a father of many nations. That's making a promise in the past tense. And that's a tremendous thing. He is calling the future a done deal, 100% certain of fulfillment. Look with me at Isaiah 46. Yes, Jesse. I assume no responsibility for other translations. Isaiah 46, verse 9 and 10. The Old Testament clearly says, I have made thee. Isaiah 46, verse 9 and 10. Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is none else. I am God and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning. And from ancient times, the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. Tremendous verse, verse 10. Declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times, the things that are not yet done. Look with me at the close of James' speech, the Council of Jerusalem, in Acts chapter 15. Acts chapter 15. And verse 18, Acts 15, verse 18. James speaking, and he's summing up, giving the decision at the Council of Jerusalem. In verse 18, James says, known unto God are all his works from the beginning of the world. Known unto God are all his works from the beginning of the world. Known in advance by God is what's going to happen and what's going to be performed. God writes history in advance, calls it prophecy. It's his story. Makes promises in the past tense. Abraham was able to accept this and to repose because he figured out two things about God. Verse 17 of Romans 4, as it is written, I have made thee a father of many nations before him whom we believe, even God, who, two things, quickeneth the dead. God makes dead ones alive. And God calls things not existing, existing. Who quickeneth the dead and calleth those things which be not as though they were. He quickens the dead. He makes dead ones alive. He's the God of resurrection. As in the case of Elisha. Elisha died. They buried him in the sepulcher, in the tomb. A year later, there's a bunch of Jews in the area. They see Moabites coming through across the desert. And they're burying someone, a fallen comrade. They're in the process of burying this guy, but hastily, to avoid being seen and destroyed by these Moabites, they stuff this guy in the tomb of Elisha. And they're hiding around, cowering, looking for the Moabites, and suddenly the guy stands up behind him and says, hey guys, what's the matter? Whoa! We just buried you! You're dead! His bones touched the bones of the body of Elisha, and he was resurrected. Imagine their surprise. The widow of Nain's son, they're carrying him on the funeral procession. Christ comes in the midst of the funeral, touches the funeral bier, and he comes to life. And they take him to his mother, and he's sitting up and speaking and talking. Abraham so believed in the God of resurrection that he was willing to slay his son Isaac, according to Hebrews chapter 11, verse 17 through 19. Do you know that's what was going through Abraham's mind? He didn't know God was going to stay his hand and keep the knife from coming down and provide a ram in the thickets. Abraham didn't know that. Abraham fully intended to plunge that knife down because he believed God could raise his son back up from the dead. That's what Hebrews 11, verse 17 through 19 says. And Abraham didn't know about the widow of Nain's son. And Abraham didn't know about the bones of Elisha. And Abraham didn't know about Jairus' daughter or about Lazarus. None of those things had taken place. But he knew he had a God who made alive dead ones. Dead ones brought back to life. God of resurrection. So he's willing to slay his own son. I have made thee a father of many nations before him whom he believed, even God who quickeneth the dead, and calleth those things which be not as though they were. Calls things not existing, existing. Things God has decreed to be, but are not yet. They're so certain of being, God says they are right now. Things that are so certain of being, but they are not yet. But God is so certain of their being, he says they are right now. I have a favorite tree out here. It's an oak tree. I like oak trees. And I especially like this one. This is one of my favorite trees in the whole world. I love to go out there and stand around and meditate and pray, or sit down and look up at it and just gaze at my oak tree, you know. Gives me peace and tranquility. I don't do it as much as I used to. I don't do it as much as I should. There's good meditation. I just love trees. I love being out in the woods, out in the Scuppernong trails and just looking at the trees and praying, meditating, just getting some peace in the midst of a hectic schedule or hectic week. So let's say I'm out there standing in front of my oak tree and I'm looking at my oak tree and thanking God for my oak tree. And it's really not mine. It's, you know, all of ours. And I'm looking up at my oak tree and I say, God, thanks for that oak tree. And God says, that's a cheetah. Thanks, God. I appreciate that input, but bark, stationary, big green leaves shaped a certain way, looks like oak tree to me, God. God says, that's a cheetah. God, cheetah move very fast. Spots, tawny hide, cat family, oak tree, stationary, very tall, leaves green, that type of thing. God says, I'm going to make that a cheetah. And I'm so certain that that's going to become a cheetah that I want you to think of it and call it a cheetah right now. It's not an oak tree anymore. It's a cheetah. It looks like an oak tree. I'm calling it a cheetah. And I begin to see the picture. I said, God, you're declaring that a cheetah because you're going to make that into a cheetah. That is so certain of fulfillment. I'm going to call that a cheetah. That is a cheetah. Now, you may think that example is absurd. God says, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things have become new. And when we talk about a new creature, we're not talking about a caterpillar goes into a cocoon and then after so long it turns into a butterfly. That's not a new creature according to the Scripture. We're talking about an entirely new creation. Not caterpillar turning into butterfly. Caterpillar becoming cheetah. Oak tree becoming cheetah. Caterpillar becoming elephant. Totally new creation. Absolutely new creation. Absolute new creation. That's not an absurd example. Look with me at Romans 8. You want to see something absurd? I'll show you something absurd. Romans chapter 8, jumping ahead a little bit. Verse 28. I'm told by some the most popular verse among Christians in the whole Bible, Romans 8, 28. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate, determine in advance, to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom he did predestinate, them he also called. Whom he called, them he also justified. Whom he justified, them he also glorified. How many in here are justified? Oh, come on. We've been through Romans 3. Romans 5 is yet to come, but you know it. How many in here are justified? Oh, I hope so. I'd have an entirely different approach to the book of Romans if only a few of you were justified in here. God says if you're justified, you're glorified, past tense. feel glorified? Look glorified? No, you don't to me either. Let's say I wake up in the morning and I look in the mirror and I look in the mirror and I see the same old scummy sin slave that was there the day before and the day before that. And I look in the mirror and say, there's that stinking old sinner again. God says, that's my blood-bought saint you're talking about. That's my beloved of God. That's my glorified son. I said, oh God, that's the same old scummy, sin-stained sinner you're talking about. God says, no, that's my beloved son. That's glorified saint, glorified. I said, God, I'm looking in the mirror. God says, I want you to look in the mirror, but I don't want you to look in that mirror. I want you to look in this mirror. You're looking in the wrong mirror. Because this gives you the face of your new birth. This gives you the face of the righteousness of God, which is by faith of Jesus Christ unto all that believe. I said, God, you're right. Glorified. Glorified means clothed in the splendor of God. It means conformed to the moral perfection of Jesus Christ. And God says, if you're born again, if you're justified, He says, you're glorified now. Past tense. I look at that oak tree, God says, Cheetah. I said, God, Cheetah, I'm with you. I'm looking in the right mirror. Hey, you're dismissed.